Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program. In an article titled "Is Hell Real?" in the Daily Beast, David Sessions describes the experience of a soldier in World War II, an experience that may have launched our current interest in near-death experiences. He writes, "In 1943, during World War II, George Ritchie was pronounced dead at an army hospital, only to wake up 9 minutes later. Ritchie went on to become a psychiatrist and write several books about those 9 minutes, in which he claimed to tour the devastation of hell in the company of Jesus Christ. Everywhere spirits were locked in what looked like fights to the death, writhing, punching, gouging," he wrote in Return from Tomorrow, originally published in 1978. "Even more hideous than the bites and the kicks they exchanged were the sexual abuses many were performing in feverish pantomime. Perversions I had never dreamed of were being vainly attempted all around us." Now, you may snort at this as the deranged visions of a dying mind, but doesn't this type of account stir at least some kind of unease in you? What if it is an after-death experience, and we have found ourselves passing through death and landing in such a situation countless times in the past? What if we will be facing it countless times in the future? Don't even such imaginings bring suffering? The reason I brought this up, of course, is because we've reached the stage in the mind training Like the Sun, the text we've been studying, that deals with the preliminary practices. One of the preliminaries the author Nam Kaur Pel encourages us to think deeply on is the various sufferings of cyclic existence, and he goes through 6 points that are commonly quoted in the Tibetan tradition. Remember, we're not thinking about the sufferings to make ourselves depressed, but to develop a strong renunciation so that we are able to practice well and quickly move out of samsara, the endless round of cyclic existence. Just recapping the sufferings we've gone through so far, they've started with uncertainty. Basically, we can be certain of nothing in this life except that we're going to die. Our relationships, the results of our activities, whatever we put our trust in, we cannot rely on any of them, neither in this life nor in coming lives. Then the second point of suffering is dissatisfaction. Everything in this type of existence leads back to dissatisfaction, from the greatest calamity to the most subtle discomfort. And nowhere in this type of existence can we find a long-term satisfaction, no matter where we go or what we do. We always come back to a sense of unease, be it painfully in our face or so subtle we hardly register it. The third and fourth points are that in cyclic existence we have to die again and again, and we have to take birth again and again. And this is the fact that the story opening the program points to. So it's in a Christian context, and of course Christianity in general does not believe in reincarnation. But the story does show that even Christians may have some experience of another life. Now, before we go on, let's set our motivation as we usually do. And let's make it a bodhicitta motivation, the wish to attain enlightenment so that we can best benefit all beings everywhere. If you really find that too difficult, then at least think of your own enlightenment. Thank you. Now, in our scientifically orientated Western world, people often find it difficult to believe in rebirth, even dismissing the idea out of hand without even bothering to look at the evidence. And yet, when we do start looking, there seems to be quite a lot of compelling evidence that going from one life to another does occur. One of the major investigators into the reincarnation phenomenon was Dr. Ian Stevenson from the University of Virginia. I have mentioned him before on the program, and I always bring him up when the topic of rebirth is discussed. He and his collaborators looked into over 2,500 cases, but what really impresses me about him is that he does not claim that rebirth exists or not. He presents his evidence, which he admits he found very compelling for the pro-argument, but leaves his readers to ultimately decide for themselves. One of his books bears this out with the title 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. In this book, he investigates 7 cases from India, 3 from Ceylon, 2 from Brazil, 7 from Alaska, and 1 from Lebanon. Something else that really impresses me about his investigations is that he is very, very thorough and scientific. This might result in his writing being a little bit dry and fussy, but it also means that it's difficult to find fault with his technique or approach. He certainly doesn't allow himself to get carried away with anything that he presents. Having said this, in telling you about one of the cases in Brazil, I'm going to quote from Dr. Stevenson himself. I hope that doesn't make you tune out. He calls it the case of Marta Lorenz, and this is what he writes. Marta Joanaria de Oliveiro, known familiarly as Sinha or Sinha Zinha, was born about 1890, the daughter of a prosperous fazendeiro, or a rancher, of Rio Grande do Sul, the southernmost state of Brazil. Her father's estate lay some 12 miles west of the small village of Dom Feliciano, which itself is about 100 miles southwest of Porto Alegre, the state's largest city and port. Sinha, to use the name by which she was most often referred, loved the rural life of her father's land on which she grew up. Nevertheless, she seems to have suffered loneliness in her somewhat isolated location. She often visited the village of Dom Feliciano and enjoyed there the friendship of Ida Lorenz, wife of F.V. Lorenz, the schoolteacher of the district. Twice, Sinha fell in love with men of whom her father disapproved. One of these men committed suicide. On the second occasion of such frustration, Sinha herself fell into a state of melancholy. Her father arranged a trip of consolation for her to the coastal city of Palota, where she attended a carnival, but with little interest. She neglected herself and tried to catch cold by exposing herself to cold, damp weather without adequate covering. She also tried to exhaust herself and even drank cold water to damage her health. Her voice thereafter became hoarse, and she was then found to have an infection of the larynx, which spread to her lungs. Her illness was diagnosed as tuberculosis, and after a few months, she died. On her deathbed, she acknowledged to Ida Lorenz that she wanted to die and that had tried to become infected. She then promised her good friend that she would return again and be born as her daughter. Sinha further predicted that, when reborn and at an age when I can speak on the mystery of rebirth in the body of the little girl who will be your daughter, I shall relate many things of my present life, and thus you will recognize the truth. Sinha died in October 1917, the day after she made this remarkable declaration. She was about 28 years old. 10 months later, on August 14, 1918, Ida Lorenz gave birth to a daughter, Marta. When Marta was 2.5 years old, she began to speak about the events in the life of Sinha. She made her first remark on the subject to her older sister, Lola. Dr. Stevenson then quotes F.V. Lorenz's account of Marta's conversation with himself and Lola. Lorenz said, "One day, when Marta was 2.5 years old, as she was returning from the stream near our house with Lola, after they had been washing clothes, she asked her sister, 'Lola, carry me on your back.' The sister, who, like all our children and neighbors, knew nothing of the deceased girl's promise to return, replied, 'You can walk well enough. I don't need to carry you.' To this, Marta replied, 'When I was big and you were small, I used to carry you often.' 'When were you big?' asked Lola, laughing. Then the little girl replied, 'At that time, I did not live here. I lived far from here, where there were many cows, oxen, and oranges, and where there were also animals like goats, but they were not goats. On this last remark, she referred to sheep. These words described the farm of the dead senior's parents in the country. Thus conversing, Lola and Marta walked on and reached the house. Then Lola told us about the strange ideas of her little sister, and I said to the latter, "My little daughter, I have never lived there where you say you have lived." To this she replied, "Yes, but in those days I had other parents." Another one of Marta's sisters then jokingly said, "And did you have a little Negro servant girl, such as we now have?" And she was referring to the little Negro orphan girl whom my wife and I had sheltered. The girl was not embarrassed and replied, "No, our Negro servant there was already big, and so was the cook. But we did have a small Negro boy, and one day he forgot to fetch the water, and my father beat him." On hearing this, I said, "I've never beaten any Negro boy, my little girl." She replied, "But it was my other father who beat him. And then the Negro boy cried out to me, 'Senya Zinya, help me.' And I asked my father not to beat him, and the little Negro boy ran off to fetch water." Then I inquired, "Did he bring water from the stream?" "No, father," Marta explained. "There was no stream there. He brought water from the well." And this was correct for the house of Senya. "Who was the Senya or Senya Zinya?" I asked. "That was myself. But then I had another name. My name was Maria, and I had one other name which I cannot remember now." Dr. Stevenson says that F.V. Lorenz reported that none of Marta's brothers or sisters knew of Senya's prediction that she would return. He and his wife hadn't told them anything about it, but Marta kept on talking about her previous life. Lorenz made meticulous notes about 120 occasions she said something about her life as Senya or the people Senya had known. Unfortunately, those notes were lost, but Lorenz rewrote what he remembered and published it in a book in 1946. And later, his son, W. Lorenz, added more information. Dr. Stevenson visited and interviewed the family in 1962 and writes that if Lorenz's notes had been kept, it would have been, and I quote, "the best witnessed and most thoroughly documented case suggestive of rebirth ever witnessed in a child." Interestingly, Marta's father only took her to meet her previous family when she was 12 years old, although she had often asked to go before that. When Dr. Stevenson interviewed her in 1962, Marta was already a married woman with kids of her own. As with most children who remember previous lives, she had moved on as she grew older. Dr. Stevenson writes, "She had forgotten much of her life of Senya, but by no means all, and said she still retained certain vivid memories of events which happened to Senya, most particularly the last scenes of Senya's life and her death from tuberculosis." However, even then, Marta powerfully felt the flow between Senya's life and her own. Dr. Stevenson continues, "As she grew older, Marta's identification with Senya persisted, especially with regard to her own children. She became preoccupied with the idea Flor Zinya, Senya's last sweetheart, might return as her own child. Flor Zinya had committed suicide after Senya's father blocked his marriage with her. Marta, then 25 years after the deaths of Senya and her sweetheart, hoped for a reunion between them, just as Senya herself had predicted a reunion with Ida Lorenz, whose daughter she said she would become. That Marta observed some evidence which satisfied her that Flor Zinya had in fact reincarnated as her own son is not of importance here. I am now concerned only with describing the strong sense of continuity between two lives which Marta experienced and still did in 1962. Now, a fascinating detail about this continuity that Dr. Stevenson talks about concerns the larynx infection and hoarseness of voice Senya had when she was dying of TB. Dr. Stevenson says that in her final days, she had a particularly painful throat and hoarse and weakened voice. He then writes, "Until the age of 10, Marta was especially vulnerable to upper respiratory infections, during which her voice would become harsh. Several of her older brothers and sisters recalled her susceptibility to such infections. Marta's own recollection of her frequent attacks of laryngitis included other details. She recalled having hoarseness continuously until the age of 9. Other witnesses thought her voice normal, except during her respiratory infections. She had, she said, such infections about once a month, and then her voice would become particularly hoarse and she would have a pain in her throat. At such times, she also felt large in her body and thought that she was going to die. Interestingly, both Sinja and Marta had phobias about rain and blood. Does this suggest that the Sinja-Marta continuity of consciousness experienced some unpleasantness to do with rain and blood in a life even previous to that of Sinja? It might seem so. Dr. Stevenson goes extensively into the people he interviewed and other details in the case, but I think we've gone far enough with it now to show the very real likelihood of rebirth having taken place here. There are many other cases like this in Dr. Stevenson's portfolio, and I must admit personally that Dr. Stevenson's work helped me a great deal to accept rebirth when I was still green in Buddhism. Much of what he reports fits with Buddhist explanation. For instance, part of his work was centered on birthmarks and people who remembered their previous lives. Often their birthmarks bore striking resemblance to wounds that such people recalled getting in another life. For instance, if someone remembered being killed by a shot in the head, they might bear birthmarks on their heads very closely resembling the entry and exit wounds caused by the bullet in the previous life. If you compare some of the photos of birthmarks on people Dr. Stevenson took with medical records of the person whose life they remember, you may be amazed. Talking about dying again and again and being reborn again and again, much more gruesome evidence for rebirth comes from the Holocaust in World War II. In 1992, Rabbi Yonasan Gershom wrote a book titled Beyond the Ashes, Cases of Reincarnation from the Holocaust. I read it some years later, and it reports on Jews who died in such horrid circumstances that their dying wish might not have been born to be Jewish again. Many were then born with blue eyes and fair hair, like their previous Aryan tormentors, but they found their lives unfulfilled, and some returned to Judaism. Here is what Rabbi Gershom wrote in his book. Non-Jews who remember having been Jewish in another life are often disturbed by this fact, feeling that they are somehow deserters from their own people, which in a sense they are. On some level, even if it was only through being confused after death, these souls did choose not to be Jewish anymore. This does not necessarily mean that they consciously said, "I want to be a blonde-eyed German." In some cases, they simply wished to be something else besides Jewish, and this desire set the pattern for the next life. After a horrible death at the hands of the Nazis, it probably seemed safer to be born into the dominant culture, without fear of being singled out for persecution. Yet now that these souls are living in a relatively open society where outright persecution is not as likely, they find that Jewish memories are coming back to haunt them. Rabbi Gershom floats the idea that the covenant between God and the Jews actually involved a promise that the Jews made that from lifetime to lifetime they would always take rebirth as Jews. But now here's an example from Rabbi Gershom's book about how someone under enormous pressure might not see it that way. He writes about the remembered experience of a Chicago housewife as a little girl in the Holocaust. "I had my coat on with my yellow star, and I was told to take off my coat. So I took off my coat, and even on my dress, I had my yellow star. I started to go through the line, and they started writing numbers on us. I remember asking my mother, 'Why are they doing this to me? But I've been a good girl.' Later on in the dream, a soldier came in, and he just said that the children were going to be taken the next day, and we were. We got in a truck, and they drove us halfway there, and I remember barbed wire was just about everywhere, and I still didn't know what was going on. This time, I was closer to 7 years old. It didn't really seem like we were there long, but it was too long. They had furnaces. I remember there were some furnaces that were in buildings, and they were brick, and they were tying some people down, strapping them down, just sticking them in. They opened up this door of the furnace, and they just started throwing the children in, one after another. And I kept looking on to see if I could find my brother. I wanted him to hold on to. I couldn't find him anywhere. Soon it came my turn. I kept telling them, "Well, I'll tell you what, I won't be a Jew." I didn't understand what was wrong with being a Jew, but apparently it wasn't good. Didn't help at all. And here's another story taken from the website of Sarah Yocheved Rigler, a Jewish woman with a strong spiritual bent who is collecting such stories for a book she wants to publish. The story concerns the life of a man called Brian Arthur Risch. The article on the website says, born in 1977 in Omaha, Nebraska, to a Roman Catholic mother and a Presbyterian father, Brian did not know a single Jew while he was growing up. At the age of 21, Brian started studying metaphysics and mysticism. One day, he walked into a Barnes & Noble in Columbus, Ohio, and bought a book that delved into six different kinds of mysticism, including Kabbalah. While studying Kabbalah, he dreamed a dream that was to recur frequently for the next 2 years. As he later described it, "I was a religious Jew with a beard and peyos. I was a scribe. I had written out Sifrei Torah and other parchments like tefillin. I saw myself putting crowns on letters. When I woke up, I would think, that's crazy. Why would anyone put crowns on letters? Then I would see myself being ushered into a shower room with a whole bunch of other Jews. I knew that the showers were really gas chambers. As I was going into the showers, I was trying to understand why this was happening to me. I'd been living a frum life. I'd fought to make sure my children married Jews. So at that time, I was extremely angry at God. Right as they were about to turn on the showers, I dropped to my knees and said, with as much anger and hatred as I could muster, God, why couldn't you have made me a Gentile? At the end of 2001, while the dream was still recurring, Brian went to a Jewish chat room online. He started chatting with an Orthodox Jew who called himself Bnei Torah. Within 3 months, Brian abandoned Christianity. 2 years later, he started the conversion process through the Chicago Rabbinical Council, the closest Beis Din to Omaha. In 2010, Brian moved to Israel, and in November 2011, he officially converted, taking the name Yitzchak. What did he take away from his recurring dream of the angry Sofar who wanted to be a Gentile? "I did not believe in past lives," asserts Yitzchak. "The only thing I could really take from the dream is not to turn against God. When I turned against God, my life got worse. Now I know it's my job to not turn against God." Yitzchak now lives in Yavneel in northern Israel. He's learning to be a sofer, and he puts crowns on letters. Rabbi Gershom's book made a particular impression on a woman who, on reading it, recognized that she too had been a victim in the Holocaust. Her name is Jewel St. James, and long before she read the book, she'd had what she calls an odd connection to Jews and their customs. For instance, she writes, "Through my teens and early 20s, I began noticing unfounded reactions to Jews in Germany. I was a waitress at a busy restaurant and enjoyed a co-worker named Sue. One day, our boss growled at Sue to pick up her order. As she balanced plates of warm pancakes on her arm, she muttered, 'Dirty Jew.' Suddenly I felt ill and was glad our boss didn't hear her. I felt ashamed, like the words were directed at me." She also writes, "Oddly, I also purchased the most gorgeous candlestick in the world for a friend. My husband said it was a Jewish menorah. I'd never heard of a menorah, but I felt great joy staring at that amazing candlestick." St. James is not a stranger to the idea of reincarnation. In fact, she had already spent 20 years researching another one of her past lives with a man named John Barron, and eventually wrote a book chronicling her research and investigation into the man 300 years before. But then she came across the book we've been discussing. She writes, "Through an odd coincidence, I found a book in the library written by Rabbi Yonasan Gershom. The book is titled Beyond the Ashes, Cases of Reincarnation from the Holocaust. He told how 6 million Jews were murdered during World War II, and the millions of baby boomers returned en masse, reincarnated with memories and personality quirks just like mine. My God, I was not alone. I gulped the book in one sitting and felt a heavy veil lifting, as if the rabbi wrote the words for me. The book described my entire life. Rabbi Geshom counseled many people who claimed they had memories of the Holocaust. He compared accounts with other analysts and hypnotherapists and noted a common thread through their stories. He observed that returned victims were born mostly between 1947 and 1953. I came along on February 12, 1953. Most were of Scandinavian descent. Many were non-Jews and knew nothing of Judaism, yet sustained tastes or habits relating to their Jewish past life. Many experienced olfactory or scent recognition, a psychic experience connecting them to their Jewish past and the Holocaust. I often smelled burning for no reason at all. The rabbi went on to say that some returnees read magazines and books from back to front, the way Hebrew books abound. "Yes, I do that," I shouted to my quiet apartment. I fit into every category, verifying what my inner self already knew. I was a reincarnated Jew. Fascinated, I consulted several psychics who all picked up glimpses of a former life in the Black Forest area of Germany. They envisioned my father involved with the underground press and eventually hauled away and killed. This interested me, so I finally submitted to past life regression where my own memories tumbled forward. I vividly recalled my family loading onto a train for the death camps. I was spared the gas chambers and death, but only for a while. I also saw the scene of my death. My clothes hung from my emaciated body with cardboard tied to my feet for shoes. A young lad, forced to join Hitler's army, hauled me into a dank room at the concentration camp, shouting to me to spill information about my father and the underground press. During the regression, I could actually feel the weakness of my starved body and foggy mind. I recognized this young officer as a boy I once loved before the war. He was horrified to hurt me, and instead of beating me with a whip he carried, he shot me quickly in the abdomen. I felt my soul lift from the famished body, and I knew my former love had killed me to save me from a far worse fate. The regression was difficult, yet explained many things from my current life. I now knew that young man reincarnated as Patrick, my teen love in this life. Patrick also died young in a car accident when he was 23. I finally understood our struggles with trust. I realized it was my destiny to once again write about my experiences with reincarnation. I finally closed the circle in 2005 when I spent 2 days at Auschwitz in Poland, where I died in that life. Painful memories that dogged this life spewed forth in a torrent of emotion as I toured the barracks and viewed the killing wall. There was that burning smell again. It took me weeks to come out of the stupor, but over time I healed and felt relief to finally understand my past and reclaim my present self. I wrote a book about my journey back to Auschwitz titled Jude. By facing the past, I can forgive, move on, and enjoy the love and safety of my current life in beautiful British Columbia. I hope my experiences will open the gates for millions who suffered the same horrific fate in the 1940s Europe, so all may heal and celebrate the life they have today. Now you can find this article titled My Reincarnation from Auschwitz on www.jewishmag.com. Now, of course, non-believers can still scoff at the idea of rebirth, but I've presented these stories today to show just some of the evidence suggestive of past lives. Dr. Stevenson built an impressive portfolio of evidence, and if you want to explore the subject further, I suggest you Google his name and you will find plenty of his material and material related to him and to others on the internet. And now time is up and we must say farewell once more. Please dedicate any positive energy from the program to gaining enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Thanks for joining the program today, and I hope we'll be together again next week. Goodbye.